It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The organization Literacy Network cites 1 in 7 adults in Dane County struggles with low literacy, and that means that's tens of thousands of people. We examine the demand for services over decades, and you can be part of the discussion. Call in with a question. You can add comments. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Robin Ryan is Executive Director of Literacy Network. Robin, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate. Thank you for inviting us on your show this morning.
Yes, so Literacy Network turning 50 this year. How have the needs of adults wanting to learn to read and other literacy skills, how has that changed since 1974?
I think the biggest factor is just the numbers are increasing. We served about 70 people when we started in the mid-70s, and last year we served over 1,440 students. So the demand is just getting bigger every year.
What might be behind that demand? What's going on?
I think certainly immigration trends, the growth in population due to immigration is probably about 25% in Dane County. So part of it is we have a lot of students coming in who want to learn English so they can integrate into the community. And then we still also serve adults who grew up in the U.S., but for whatever reason in their education background didn't acquire the skills they need to succeed. So we still have native speakers coming in for basic language skills and GED preparation. But really the growth is on the immigration side.
Have like advancements in technology affected demand? I wonder, you know, what about the effects of digital literacy skills?
That certainly one of the things we do is provide training on and instruction on computer skills. So those basic skills of reading, writing, math, and now computer skills, people coming in just so they can communicate in daily life, but also for employment, wanting to have those basic digital skills. And that's both our native speakers and our people who are learning English.
When everything went virtual in the pandemic, what did Literacy Network learn from that type of experience?
Well, like every other place in the country, we offered digital services. So we moved over to Zoom classes for our students and also did a lot of support because a lot of our students were in jobs that were immediately lost during the pandemic. So we did a lot of resource support for our students and offered the digital, the Zoom classes. We needed to provide a lot of people computers and just access to internet in order to participate in those classes. So we became better at providing the technical the computers. And then when the pandemic eased, we learned that some people really wanted to stay on Zoom. They're working, they're perhaps have kids at home, and it was a nice addition to be able to have Zoom classes, particularly for the learners who had higher English language skills. But for the basic level and lower level students, they wanted to come back in person. So almost all of our programming is back in person.
Okay, that face-to-face component is still strong in building literacy skills. Is that a takeaway there?
That's a takeaway. And just the camaraderie and support and community. We are working with students from over 85 countries. And having a place in Madison where you can come and feel community and feel support is certainly part of it, in addition to having that face-to-face language practice.
We're talking about adult literacy education. Robin Ryan is Executive Director of Literacy Network that is based in Dane County. And you can join in with questions and comments at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. And now let's hear from Angie Rojas Agudelo, a human resource generalist with Dane Manufacturing. That's a metal fabrication company in Wanakee. Angie, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, Kate. Good morning. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Good morning. So Dane Manufacturing sponsors classes through Literacy Network for its employees. Can you explain what needs Dane Manufacturing employees have?
Yes. Well, a couple of years ago, we started getting a lot of new employees whose second language was English. So it came out of our employees. They know Dane is very supportive, and they had the idea that maybe I, as a bilingual staff there, could teach them English. And they said they would put together some money and pay me so I could teach them off-site. And I said, well, thank you so much for trusting me to do that. Let's look at maybe some better options. I know that teaching a second language is not just something someone can do when they're bilingual. There's some instruction you can take, there's studies, so there's other people that are trained for that. So we brought this up to our leadership and they were very supportive. They said, let's go for it. And we connected with Literacy Network. One of the things that we liked about Literacy Network's approach was that they have evidence-based best practice for teaching a second language. So that was huge. And we have seen the results from that in this a few semesters we've had Literacy Network come to our shop.
Yeah, so you see a change. What effects have you noticed from workers who take classes for English as a second language?
Well, right away, the first semester we did, we noticed a great improvement in their confidence of trying to speak English. We realized that some of them were at a very beginner level because Literacy Network does testing at like a baseline testing. And so some others have a few skills that they had developed either because they studied English before in their countries or had some exposure, or they've been here in the country for a few years. So some of them needed just that confidence to be able to start trying to speak English. And we saw that right away. And then after a couple semesters, when Literacy Network repeated the testing, we saw the increase. Most everybody went up levels.
Robin, what are the classes like for students who speak another first language?
Well, all of our classes are immersion classes in English, and we use curricula, and we do have leveled classes here at our facility and some places across the county, as well as with some employers. We also have kind of looser leveled classes at schools and community centers and libraries all across Dane County, so the classes are really accessible. And we also have, beyond the traditional instructor led classes, we have lots of tutoring classes where we bring together eight pairs of students and volunteer tutors, and our staff write lesson plans for each individual pair every week. So this is wonderful because we have, and this goes back 50 years, we've always had tremendous, wonderful pool of volunteers in Dane County. And we have, over the years, figured out how to make best use of the volunteers so that they are provided support and students get that one-on-one individualized attention. So we just have all sorts of variety of classes and all places across Dane County that's going to meet the needs of the students.
But with the increased demand, does Literacy Network have enough volunteers to meet the demand for services?
We never have enough. If we open an English language class, it fills immediately. So it's not just the volunteers, it's also the support for training and writing lesson plans and hiring more instructors. So we need always just more classes, more administrative support, and then of course more tutors. So we can always use more. We welcome tutors. Please visit our website and we'd love to have you become a tutor.
Robin Ryan leads the organization Literacy Network, serving Dane County. Angie Rojas Agudelo works in human resources at Dane Manufacturing, that's in Wanakee. Call in with a question. You can share your experiences, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Literacy skills include reading, writing, listening, and speaking. We explore how a Dane County organization seeks to meet the needs of adults to improve quality of life and job opportunities. Robin Ryan is Executive Director of Literacy Network, established 50 years ago. Angie Rojas Agudelo is in Human Resources at Dane Manufacturing. Be part of the discussion about literacy. You can call in with a question, share your thoughts, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Angie, Dane Manufacturing uses something called Pocket Talkers to better communicate with employees who aren't fluent in English. Can you explain how these Pocket Talkers work?
Yes, well, when I initially came to Dane, I was only going there part-time. And when we started hiring primarily Spanish-speaking staff, there was a language barrier, obviously, for training or when I was not there. So we looked into some devices that are called Pocket Talkers. They're almost like the Google Translate or an automatic translator. But the nice thing about it is that you talk to the device in English or Spanish, or it also works for other languages, but then it processes the translation automatically, and then you can hear it translate, play it to the person, and then the person talks back to it. And it's a small device that fits in your pocket. You can take it everywhere. So it was used for a while at the beginning. But then now, honestly, with the Literacy Network classes and me being there full time, I don't even know where we have them right now.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I wonder, though, at first, was there any stigma you noticed around the use of Pocket Talkers?
No, I think they were very receptive of, you know, this is a tool we can use. There was obviously an understanding that it was not to replace a human interpreter, but it could help for those last minute, not as important conversations. Mm-hmm. We were fortunate to have bilingual staff already that had been working with us before. So that was very helpful in the training. But we understand bilingual staff have other responsibilities, and due to some privacy and confidentiality issues, it's also good to have an interpreter.
Sure. Robin, as we look at that technology, like Pocket Talkers, I mean, there are so many apps for the phone that can also help to boost literacy. What are your impressions there about using apps like that?
Well, certainly, you know, we have people coming in speaking all different languages, and when they come in and want to enroll in classes, there are times when we use Google Translate, but really people want to be able to talk to each other one-to-one. I mean, the goal is to learn English so you can be fully part of the community. So apps certainly help. But in our classes, we're teaching English. It's all based on becoming fully proficient in English so you can participate in everything. So you don't have to rely on a device.
Angie, what kind of work are employees at Dane Manufacturing doing?
Well, at Dane Manufacturing, we're full circle. We get the raw metal and then process it all the way to shipping. It gets cut, formed, welded, sanded, polished, painted, packed, and then it gets sent out. So we have employees working along all that process. So we have employees that receive material and then load it into our machines, get them processed and out. And so we have painters, we have general laborers, shipping associates, material handlers, all different types of jobs that go along that process.
And communication among those supply chains and making things come together like that, I would imagine communication is huge.
Yes. And, you know, communication, obviously verbal and using the language, written communication. So we have some translations available. We have employees who are bilingual. And then we have a professional interpreter on staff. So it's all working together And it's really great to see that integration, like Robin was mentioning earlier, how learning English helps the community get together and learn from each other. We're seeing our English speaking employees also picking up some Spanish, and now we have a great community.
From the HR side of this, has it helped your company retain or attract new employees?
Definitely, 100%. We have a waiting list of people wanting to work at Day Manufacturing.
Wow. Wow.
Yes.
And that has happened since you have been able to sponsor these English classes and really focus on the support around literacy and English as a second language.
Definitely. I think that employees see that willingness from Day Manufacturing to invest in their future, in their advancement, and the English classes are definitely a big part of that. Along other things we do at Dane, we're always promoting trainings. We have continuing education classes. We're looking into some other classes people can take. And obviously, we have the language support with the classes and with the interpretation and translation.
I think it speaks to me as an example of a company really reaching into the quality of life of employees and looking more holistically at their employee.
Yes, very much so. We want our employees to be successful inside Dane and also outside Dane. We talk to them about their benefits that they get through employment, how to call to the dentist and get an appointment, how to be seen by a doctor, all those things that are important. Understand their paycheck, taxes, how all that works that comes with also coming from another country and learning all these new things and how our systems work here in the United States.
Angie Rojas Agudelo and Robin Ryan are here. Angie at Dane Manufacturing, Robin leading adult literacy education at Literacy Network. Call in along the way, questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Robin, Literacy Network offers citizenship classes. What is covered in these classes?
Yes, we do offer citizenship classes and tutoring. And for people who are eligible to apply for citizenship, one of the things they have to do is take an exam face to face. Part of it is on English language and part of it is on civics. So we prepare people both for the English language piece of it and the civics test.
How proficient do people need to be in English in order to pass the citizenship class?
They have to be able to carry on a conversation with the examiner.
Is that a barrier? Is that difficult?
Well, we have very high success rate because we prepare people. I think without, certainly people can do this on their own, but with the support and the practice, we have almost all people, all of our students passing the test. So yes, it's difficult, but it's certainly something that our students are able to achieve.
Angie, are Dane Manufacturing employees taking the citizenship class?
And that's funny that you mentioned that because we don't offer the citizenship classes through Day Manufacturing, but we have one of our employees who's currently or was last semester taking his citizenship classes through Literacy Network.
And so making the connection there. Robin, there's been so much discussion about the trend toward the science of reading and, teaching phonics and how to teach for young kids. And it makes me wonder if the way adults are being tutored and the educational approaches, are those evolving with the science for adult literacy?
Well, I will admit that I am not an instructor and I rely on our instructors to pick the best curriculum, but we certainly stay up with what is, the evidence-based best curriculum. We and our instructors certainly stay up in the field on what we should be offering, but we haven't seen lots of changes in how we're teaching over the last, decade or so. And I will add, may I add on the
Sure.
citizenship piece
Yeah.
too? We recently were awarded a grant from U.S. Citizenship Services to provide these citizenship classes, and one of our classes is on Zoom, and we are actually going to be adding a class this summer, kind of on the northeast side of Madison. So that is again another growing part of what we do.
That is a growth area. So, in our last few moments, what might the next half century look like for Literacy Network?
Growth. I invite people to come to our 50th anniversary event. It is April 25th at Boardman Clark from 7 to 9 p.m. And you can hear stories about how our services have impacted students over the last 50 years and hear more about the needs. But certainly we need more classes, we need more volunteers, we need more support. Mm-hmm. And we suspect that we also will be also growing on the side of, for example, GED preparation. So every and citizenship. So everything is growing right now.
Scaling up. Yeah.
More is 50 years is more.
Well, thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank
Kate.
You for having us.
Robin Ryan, Executive Director of Literacy Network. Angie Rojas Agudelo, Human Resources Generalist at Dane Manufacturing in Wanakee. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks to a suggestion, Tina in Oshkosh, we learn about strain on vocal cords and other voice disorders. Teachers, actors, salespeople on calls during the day, these are some examples of occupations with more vocal stress. And you can be part of the conversation. Call in with a question. You can add your views at 800-642-1234. Wendy Fabiziak is a speech-language pathologist in Oshkosh, specializing in voice disorders and vocal cord dysfunction. Wendy, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, Kate. Thanks for having me.
Yes. So as temperatures cool, does vocal cord dysfunction become more common? Is there any seasonal connection?
Oh, good question. Anything that can be potentially irritating to the vocal cords can trigger more issues with it. Very extreme cold, dry air certainly can trigger, as well as the humid, hot air itself. So both season extremes do tend to increase some symptoms with this.
So the Cleveland Clinic says stress is also a common cause of vocal cord dysfunction. What are some other causes?
Well, yeah, originally we saw vocal cord dysfunction as generating as a result of irritation. So a lot of times that was about internal irritation in terms of perhaps post-nasal drainage, reflux that was coming up from the stomach, creating irritation in the throat. And our body is very good at protecting the vital organs. So those vocal cords would start to close, shutting any potential passage into the lungs, which started to then create some of the symptoms of shortness of breath, coughing, throat clearing, etc. So that irritation, but it isn't just internal irritants, things in the air during the Canadian wildfires, certainly that was irritating. Fumes, pollens, things that people may be allergic to, all increase the propensity to develop some issues with this.
Can you step back for a moment and give us like a working knowledge or a tour of this part of our anatomy and how the voice box works?
Oh, absolutely. It really helps. And with my patients, it's a huge component of the therapy because when people understand their own anatomy, it helps. The idea of not being able to catch your breath becomes very terrifying. And unfortunately, it feeds the symptoms because a lot of this can also occur as a result of stress, as you mentioned. So the voice box is situated, the larynx, Adam's apple, all the same thing. We all have one right in the middle of the throat. If we look down that voice box, our vocal cords are situated right in the middle of that. They open and close and are literally the doorway down into the lungs, which is underneath those vocal cords. So when the vocal cords are wide open, there is free air exchange up and down from the lungs, out the mouth and nose when we're breathing. What happens during vocal cord dysfunction is there is a slight closure. And that closure can range from pretty significant to very mild. It can come and go quickly. It can stick with you for hours. But that's basically what's happening, subsequently creating symptoms of difficulty drawing in a deep breath of air, feeling that that air that I take in doesn't feel fulfilling, like it's not, like it's traveling through too much tension in my throat. It can create coughing, it can create throat clearing, voice issues, all associated with this, occasionally even some swallowing problems.
So what happens if those, if there's inflammation in the vocal cords, what, you know, I'm thinking even of laryngitis, what happens then?
Well, and to tell you the truth, now as we're learning more and more about this condition, we know now that this is often set off by something like laryngitis, by an upper respiratory illness, by that kind of thing. And of course, we just went through having a lot of people have COVID, and I am certainly seeing a lot of fallout of that now. Inflammation is not a necessary component of this condition, but certainly when there's a lot of chronic irritation, like nasal drainage, like reflux, it can add another dimension to it. If there is inflammation, that's basically puffing up the vocal cords, swelling them a little bit, which further narrows that airway tract.
Hmm. Can medications or prescriptions you're on, can that cause problems in the voice box?
It can cause drying. There are a lot of medications that can cause drying. Our voice box likes to be nice and moist. It's mucosal tissue. So drying medications can be an issue. The other issue is, in the past, we always just would hand someone an inhaler, frequently riddled with steroids, and say, try this, use this. The problem was steroids, inhalers, albuterols, those types of things open the bronchioles down lower in the lungs. But that's not what this condition is. It's not about asthma. That the inhalers will treat asthma, but this is more up at the level of the throat of our voice box. And we're finding that actually some of those inhalers, most of them, are actually creating even more irritation and certainly not helping, if anything, perhaps even making things a bit worse.
The Mayo Clinic says that vocal cord dysfunction can be misdiagnosed as asthma. How do you tell the difference between vocal cord dysfunction and asthma?
And that's a huge piece of education for my patients, is recognizing. And it is very common for me to treat people that have both these conditions. It's identifying where the symptoms occur. I talk to people about the breathing apparatus, almost just like an upside down tree. The trunk is our throat. The tree branches come out, get lowered down into our chest and our lungs. If there's more of a pressure sensation, a tightness, low, a stinging, a burning down lower in the chest, that's often more associated with asthma. But these patients with vocal cord dysfunction are more so feeling a tension up higher at the level of the throat, where it's almost like effortful, muscular. There may be some tension or even tenderness, pain in the throat itself. That should not be occurring in asthma.
We're talking about voice disorders with Wendy Fabiziak, speech-language pathologist. You can join in with your questions and your experiences. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Wendy, when you look at a cross-section of your patients, who is most likely to experience vocal cord dysfunction?
Female. About 80% female. However, other than that, what we do see is a predominance of this in middle school, high school girls. I also see it a lot in people that professions involve a lot of talking, like teachers, where they're trying to get out a lot of words in a short amount of time, not really breathing appropriately. I've also seen this case with people that have gone through some significant stressful events. I had a patient that was raped. I'm dealing more with PTSD, some of the soldiers. So certainly high stress issues that come around can cause this in and of itself also.
Why women and girls?
You know, it's we're questioning it. We're looking at hormones a bit, the researches. However, I do believe there's something about that females tend to seek help more from a medical professional. So the females are coming and going, oh, this just doesn't feel right. Where men tend to wait unless it's really significant. And this is more of a chronic kind of irritation. So I think some men are just dismissive of it.
So a chronic type of irritation, is vocal cord dysfunction something that a person can self-diagnose?
In essence, you know, to get a very specific diagnosis, we have to put a scope, a small laryngoscope, through the nose, down the throat, and observe the vocal cords misbehaving and the symptoms happening. The problem is these symptoms vary very quickly. Like I said, it may persist for hours, but it may only occur for a minute or two. So if we're not looking at the vocal cords at that very moment that it is occurring, it won't actually diagnose it. There was a day where insurance is required that in order to get treatment, but now this is becoming much more just symptom driven. The symptoms are very specific, very specialized to this disorder. So it is something that people almost can, yes.
Do you find, you know, in the procedure of going, you know, up the nose and back down, I mean, is that done without any sedation? You know,
it is. Okay. There is no sedation. However, they often will spray some lidocaine, which is a numbing agent, into the nose. So it's not necessarily painful, but it does feel awkward, a little gaggy. And when you're already feeling like it's hard for you to catch your breath and you're struggling with perhaps breathing and or coughing, throat clearing, it's not a pleasant experience. So like I said, these days we're not doing it as consistently with the scope.
Wendy Fabiziak is a speech language pathologist in Oshkosh, helping us to understand vocal problems and different therapy approaches that we'll get into. You can be part of this discussion. Call in with the question. You can share comments along the way. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks to an email request from Tina in Oshkosh, we learn about vocal cord dysfunction and how it's more common than we might think. Speech-language pathologist Wendy Fabiziak fields your questions about causes, treatments, and exercises that can help to restore the voice. You can join the conversation and ask your question. Call 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Wendy, what therapies exist for vocal cord dysfunction? What are options?
Well, it's primarily treated with the assistance of a speech therapist, myself. A big component of the treatment is identifying the symptoms, understanding the symptoms, realizing that although the symptoms can be quite scary, they cannot take your life. Worst case scenario, I've worked with probably 1,000+ people. Less than 5 have actually passed out, but that is the worst case scenario in this condition. Once the body relaxes, then the breathing mechanism works naturally. But getting them into therapy, it's not long-haul treatment, usually anywhere from 1 to 5 sessions, but teaching them to not only identify their triggers, I work with them on learning to relax the laryngeal structure, the throat itself, the voice box, letting that relax so that the movement of the air is more free. I teach specific breathing strategies to compensate for what is going on with the vocal cords.
Do you typically need a referral to see a speech language pathologist?
You do. I do need a physician referral. That often comes from the form of ENTs, pulmonologists, allergists, but this condition that we just became aware of in the 80s has finally come into the mainstream, and primary care physicians are also referring to me now too. In fact, they're very receptive to sending somebody over for therapy. It's a relatively inexpensive treatment that can really help very quickly.
We heard from Juliet in Bayfield, called in, and Juliet says their son has breath control issues in speaking and communicating due to trauma as a baby. And Juliet would like to know what exercises or treatment is out there.
Oh, boy, that's a tough one. And it depends on how old he is. Although when it comes to this, I have worked with anywhere from 4 to 94, but really teaching him how to better manage the diaphragm and the appropriate breathing strategies. The problem is we have a lot of emphasis right now on breathing. It's very prominent in the schools with our children, but to get the kids using breathing that is actually an effective breathing technique that can actually help calm the system and allow the airflow to coordinate more effectively with the voicing is an entirely different matter. Being able to truly use the diaphragm correctly, it really doesn't take a lot of work, but it takes educating, practicing, and showing someone truly how that works rather than the idea of just taking a big deep breath, because that in no way is using the diaphragm.
Let's bring on a call. Nancy is with us in Milwaukee. Nancy, what is your question?
I'm a 91-year-old person. I've had a 45-year history of Barrett's throat, and as of late, my voice has very much changed, as you can tell. What does this person know about Barrett's throat, please?
Nancy, thank you. Wendy?
Well, Barrett's esophagus, or Barrett's throat, has to do with irritation of reflux in the esophagus. Oftentimes, if the reflux is making it all the way up into the esophagus, it can go even further up into the throat. Once that reflux hits the throat, it is ripe to then fall down and hit the vocal cords. That reflux, very caustic, acidic, is very damaging to the voice box and to the vocal cords. It also can be causative in both vocal cord dysfunction and voice problems, having difficulties in using the voice. Barrett's esophagus absolutely needs to be treated with medication to get that under control.
Nancy, thank you for the call. Christina in Glenwood now. Christina, hi.
Hi there. Thank you. I'm curious to know if the heat from our morning coffee or tea affects the vocal cords. And also, if it does, is there a certain temperature that we should not exceed?
Wendy.
Wow. That's a great question. So here's the reality of it. When we're drinking something like coffee or tea, there literally are two tubes in the back of our throat. The back tube goes all the way down to the stomach. That is your esophagus. That is where your coffee or tea are going to go, down that back tube. There is a tube right in front of that, the trachea. The trachea is where our voice box or our larynx is located. Liquids like coffee and tea do not go into that voice box. That would be aspiration, because then it would be going down into our lungs. That is definitely not good. So I've had singers that are really hyper-focused on what they're swallowing. The reality of it is that it isn't touching the vocal cords. But in general, heat is good for muscle relaxation. Stress causes tension, particularly to muscles about the throat and the larynx. So although drinking hot beverages don't necessarily do a whole lot, what I've found to be very effective with my patients is using like a hot pad, a rice bag that you can heat up, and putting that literally around some of the muscles around the front of the throat to penetrate more effectively into the voice box.
Talking about voice disorders with Wendy Fabiziak, speech-language pathologist, fielding your questions at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org. Okay, Wendy, do you recommend throat lozenges to help treat symptoms of vocal tiredness? What do you say about throat lozenges?
Well, here's what I have to say. Absolutely, helping with secretions is good. However, most throat lozenges are riddled with menthol, mints, all of which are very drying and can also frequently stir up that reflux, that acid in the stomach, pretty significantly. So they are not particularly recommended. Rather, I suggest something like a sugar-free fruit breeze, that type of thing. Because again, having something to suck on can be effective. Most effective is simply having some water. I have some right here with me. When this is happening to people, swallowing can really be just an effective little strategy just to gain some control. So swallowing water is the best thing we can do for ourselves.
Any insights on honey? Does honey help at all?
You know, honey has wonderful healing properties, but again, that honey is going down the back in the esophagus, and it is not actually getting into the voice box or the larynx. So I have no problems with honey. I think it's great, just not super effective in terms of actually, quote, coating the vocal cords, which I hear people say sometimes it does not do that.
Psychologically, we feel like it's
exactly. It feels good.
Some yoga styles and mental health therapies use breathing exercises as part of their practice. Could these breathing exercises help with vocal cord dysfunction?
Absolutely, if done correctly. And it's always curious to me when people say, well, I do yoga a lot and they encourage diaphragm breathing. And I'll say, great, show me your diaphragm breathing. And most of the time, people's assumption of that is simply taking a deep breath in. But it also involves literally using this large muscle right under our rib cage, the diaphragm, effectively. There should be no movement of the chest, shoulders, accessory muscles up in that chest. The act to only clench and tighten the muscles of the voice box. So the diaphragm, on the other hand, has a nerve that literally runs from it, wraps around and goes up to that voice box. When fully effectively engaging the diaphragm, it communicates to the voice box and says, relax, open, we're breathing now.
Do patients ever need surgery to treat vocal cord dysfunction?
Not typically, no. This is not something that we can modify the vocal folds for. We only do that in cases of like paralysis of a vocal cord. So no, this is something that's treated more behaviorally. And again, recognizing what this is, that it feels like I can't catch a breath, often induces a bit of panicking, which makes the whole thing worse. But when they understand fully what it is, it really helps kind of backpedal, I should say, and get into the breathing modality that they're supposed to be using.
In our last 15 seconds or so, you said water is next to you. What other thing would really help us protect our vocal cords?
Avoiding loud screaming in the back of our throat, that go, you know, at Packer games or what have you. the way we use our voice, we can be loud, but we can't be loud and really put a lot of emphasis on those, on that throat itself. Too much caffeine is not great for the voice. Too much alcohol is not great for the voice, because again, those things tend to lead to reflux, which again can be quite damaging. Overusing, abusing the voice. Again, if you know how to do it, it's okay.
Wendy, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's been a pleasure.
Wendy Fabiziak, speech language pathologist. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We explore the Upper Peninsula of Michigan with travel writer Paul Vachon. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a Waukesha doula. It's part of a series we're airing this month on women in southern Wisconsin in partnership with Midwest Mujeres. And as a warning, the story talks about the death of a child.
When Tamara Thompson of Waukesha was becoming a doula, there was a lesson on the history of midwifery that stuck with her.
And Mama Shafia gave a really powerful presentation that took us back. to the South, took us back to when African people walked on this land and practiced midwifery on a very different pretense than what I had previously considered before. Like, the midwives are a trusted pillar in their community. And I remember being able to make the connection, like, whoa, that's where the power is. And so it was like my bones vibrated inside my body. And it was like the ancestors were telling me, you're supposed to be a midwife.
Thompson's also become an advocate for reproductive justice, focusing on issues like breastfeeding at work and hospital birthing policies. She told me about this as part of a storytelling partnership with Midwest Mujeres.
Like, when I first took the doula training, and I'm thinking about the statistics that more African-American babies die than other races. And I thought more mothers that look like me die than other races. And I thought, so I need to prepare myself for one of my doula babies not making it. And that happened. And it was earth-shattering. It was heartbreaking. And then it happened to me.
Thompson gave birth to a healthy little girl named Damara in fall 2021.
It was an absolute victory, the way that we brought her into the world. You know, the doulas and myself and my husband, and we danced her earthside. And at 3 months old, she was sick. And I took her to her pediatrician, and, you know, she was coughing there in clinic. And I thought, you know, let's see what's going on with baby girl, my baby girl, Damara. And they did the COVID test, the influenza test, you know, all the things, listened to her lungs. And we thought it was a virus that needed to run its course. And my baby girl died 4 days later. And I thought, how could this happen to me?
The shock was palpable.
Yeah. How could this happen to me? I am out there. I'm at the Capitol. I'm in joint finance committee meetings. I'm advocating in these hospital boardrooms for people to have more autonomy and dignity in birth. I'm doing the work, but it happened to me. And it blew me away. And it changed the way that I stand up and I speak.
During Damara's life, she was able to join her mother at the Capitol to push for change. You can see them together in a press conference broadcast by Wisconsin Eye. Thompson holds her one-month-old daughter while she advocates for the Wisconsin Birth Equity Act, a package of bills to reduce racial inequities and eliminate maternal and newborn health disparities.
Peace. Good morning, everyone. My name is Damara Thompson. This is Damara Howard.
And I thought, yes, that's her legacy. That's what she stands for. And of course, I thought I'd have a lifetime with her. But when she died, and, you know, I totally lost it for a while there. I needed to just go into the depths of what grief was like. But coming, you know, to the surface a little bit to say, that's what her legacy is going to be. And I'm going to carry that fire in me everywhere I go. And every time I speak and every person I touch is going to be in that name, Damara.
Damara Thompson of Waukesha is a mother, doula, and reproductive justice advocate. She shared her story with us as part of a partnership with Midwest Mujeres in Madison. We've partnered with the organization to share stories of women who live in southern Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. I'm Maureen McCollum.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Michigan author Paul Vachon says water shapes the character of the Upper Peninsula, home to more than 4,000 inland lakes,
12,000 miles of rivers, and hundreds of named waterfalls. We explore the spectacular beauty and the adventures of our neighbor next door, and you can call in with a question or share comments. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Paul Vachon is author of Moon Michigan's Upper Peninsula, Scenic Drives, Waterfalls, Lakeside Getaways, the guidebook now in its sixth edition. Paul, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you for having me, Kate. It's wonderful to be here.
So your book is divided into chapters partially based on different regions of the Upper Peninsula. So which region would you recommend that we visit in the spring?
Well, for readers from Wisconsin, I'm in Michigan. I'm from the Detroit area. But the area closest to Wisconsin is the area of the Upper Peninsula we refer to as the Superior Upland. And there's a chapter devoted to that in the book. And it basically stretches from the area of Menominee, which is right across from Marionette in Wisconsin. And then it kind of arcs upward towards the town of Ironwood. It goes a little further east than that. It goes to pretty much where Silver City is, which includes the Porcupine Mountains. It includes a number of other wilderness areas and so forth. So if I had to cite one highlight of that region, and there's a lot of nice things, the one that I would single out mostly is the Porcupine Mountains. It's a state park in Michigan, is Porcupine Mountains Wilderness State Park. It's the largest state park in the entire state of Michigan, and it's pretty rustic. It's a great place.
Yeah, you call the Porkies, as they call them, a majestic highlight. So, and there are hikes, there are things you can do around the Porkies. How visible is Lake Superior from, like, the trails at the Porcupine Mountains Wilderness State Park?
It varies a little bit. Because you're in the mountain, well, they're not literally mountains, they're hills. But if you're down in a valley or something, then you probably won't see it. But if you... As soon as you, and the trails often, you know, go uphill and they ascend to different tops of mountains and things like that. And I would say at least 50% of the time when you're towards the peak of one of these hills, you can easily see Lake Superior. It's, and because you're less than probably 10 or 15 miles from the coast usually.
So what is the difference in between like the Superior Upland and the northern highlands of the Upper Peninsula? You know, what varies in these landscapes?
Well, as you go a little bit further east from the Superior Upland and you get towards, first of all, the Keweenaw, that's something else entirely. That's more the old mining area, and that's a little hilly too. But when you get a little further east, maybe towards the Marquette area, the land becomes more level, and there is a slightly, although very slightly, higher population density. And you'll see a lot of things that are maybe more conventional tourist attractions, if I may say that. The National Skiing Hall of Fame is actually in Ishpeming, which is not too far from Marquette. Then there's a number of other ski resorts in that area for winter tourism. And then in Marquette itself is Northern Michigan University, which is a great place. And in the same region in Hancock, that's in the Keweenaw, is Michigan Technological University. And these are all very, very cultured places, and they're more eclectic, certainly, than the pure wilderness areas.
In terms of islands, Isle Royale National Park is one of the least visited properties in the national park system. We learned that in the guidebook. So, what is there to see in this secluded park? What would you recommend?
There's two kinds of tourists that can go to Isle Royale. One is for people that are probably not as adventurous from an outdoors perspective, can go just for a day trip. They can take a ferry from, I think, either Wisconsin. I'm trying to remember the name of the town. But I'm thinking more Michigan, from Copper Harbor or from Houghton Hancock. And you can spend like a day there and then get the ferry on the way back in the evening. The other mode of visiting would be for the more dedicated hiker. And there is a series of trails that go from one end to the other. Isle Royal is actually several islands. It's an archipelago. And there are several inland lakes in it, which offer great fishing. And there's also some wildlife, too. There's a fairly robust moose population. And the federal government right now is gradually restoring the wolf population, which just about died out over the years. There was a lot of inbreeding, and that lack of genetic diversity caused the wolf population to die off. But that's being revived. And there's you know, some interesting peaks and valleys and so forth like that on the in the main part of Isle Royal.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a fascinating place. The area, and I don't say town, but because there aren't any, at the far northern tip is a place called Rock Harbor. And if you want to stay there and you're not a camper, that's the only place you can stay. It's the park operates like a lodge there.
Okay.
It is very expensive, I hate to say. But then at the other end of the park is a place called Windigo, and that is basically a trailhead for hikers to set out. There's like a general store there and a few other amenities. But for the most part, the island is pure raw nature. For people who do like to maybe fish along in addition to their camping and backpacking, there are a number of small inland lakes which offer terrific fishing. And there's an interesting loophole too. If you are fishing on one of those inland lakes, you do not need a Michigan fishing license. However, if you fish in Lake Superior outside, you do. So
interesting. Paul Vachon, author of Moon Michigan's Upper Peninsula, our travel guide to the UP, and you can be part of this excursion. Call in with a question, share your experiences, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We have travel writer Paul Vachon calls Mackinac City the gateway to the Upper Peninsula of Michigan and is giving us tips on where to rest and stretch after a long car ride to the UP. We explore the beauty next door, and you can be part of the discussion. Call in with a question, share your experiences, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Paul Vachon is author of Moon Michigan's Upper Peninsula, now in its sixth edition. Let's go to Vicki in Mequon. Vicki, hi. What would you like to ask?
Hi, perfect segment for me. I was just sitting down to plan about an 8 or 9 day trip to the Upper Peninsula with some of my siblings from Arizona to see the fall colors this year. We're going to be going from September 25th to about August 4th. And we thought we would start out in Marquette and end up in Traverse City. So I was wondering if you have recommendations on, you know, where to kind of, we were thinking of two Airbnbs in each location, you know, as an anchoring point. But are there some highlights that we should not miss? And recommendations on which towns or areas to stay in? And just to say, we're in our 60s and 70s, so we're more of a sightseeing than, you know, climbing.
Maybe sure. Yeah. Good. Well, perfect timing, Vicki. Paul, go ahead.
Okay. Thanks for calling, Vicki. I think you said you expect to start your trip in the Marquette area. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Well, if you're going to start there and then kind of proceed easterly, southeasterly, the one place you absolutely have to visit is Tuquamonon Falls. And Tuquamonon Falls is at a place called, it's a little town. The town is actually called Paradise. It's on Whitefish Bay, and it's a there's actually, it's a state park. There's actually two falls. There's the Upper Falls and the Lower Falls that are part of the Quamanon River. And it's called, they call them the Root Beer Falls. And the reason they call them that is there's a number of cedar trees that line the river. And when the cedar chips fall off, they acidify into the, when they hit the water, and it kind of gives the water like a brownish tint to it. And it looks like root beer when you see the waterfall. So it's really kind of interesting. It's the most, I think it's in fact, I know it's the most highest volume of water of any waterfall east of the Mississippi, with the exception, of course, of Niagara Falls.
Wow.
So it's a great place. You got to see it. If you go to the Upper Falls there, which is the more dramatic of the two, there's a little visitor center with a nice restaurant nearby. And you could also, if you do want to do some hiking, there's a trail that goes from the Upper Falls down to the Lower Falls. It's about 2 miles, I think. And so it's if you go that time of year, it's certainly best in terms of, you know, photography, if you want to do nature photography, in terms of the colors. And you can also, at Taquamina Falls, but in other places, if you get lucky, you can find wildlife too. And that's a good time to photograph moose. The moose are in the area closer to Marquette. It's in the Huron Mountains area, although some of that is restricted to visitors. But there is a moose population there that you can see. And then if you continue after that, and if you go all the way down to if you go past the Mackinac Bridge, instead of crossing right into the Lower Peninsula, if you go past the Mackinac Bridge, you can get to the Lake Chinon area, which is on the Lake Huron side. And there are some wonderful, wonderful small towns there. One of them is a town called Hessel. And there's a great place there. It's a school that teaches cooking. It's called the Les Chinon Culinary School. And in the off season, well, in the summer and I think early fall, I don't know exactly when they close, they operate as a restaurant, and it's a great, great place.
Oh, that is such great insights here. Now, the Les Chinon Islands, these are like dozens of really narrow islands off the and so also great for boaters, I would imagine.
Oh yeah, there's a lot of they have a boat show in August every year, and then there's also the whole island. Some of them you can camp on, some you cannot, but there's marinas, boat clubs. Some of them are private, but some are not. Some of them are like public restaurants and things like that. It's an under-publicized place. You know, even a lot of people in Michigan don't know about it.
How is the lodging situation in the fall? Any tips there?
You have to be a little careful, because some places that are more geared to summer tourists, they close down by then. So you want to check in advance. I would say maybe 50% of the places might still be open by then, and then some of those close down maybe like around Christmas time. But around the fall, you can find a number of good accommodations. You can find chain hotels. You can find bed and breakfast, as I mentioned. And then you can also find something that is kind of a endangered species these days, and these are some of these old mom-and-pop motels, if you will. And there's not as many as there used to be, but there are some of them scattered around too. So those are, and they tend to be a lot more affordable than the chains. So.
On the topic of waterfalls, Bond Falls, you really think that one stands out? Can you tell us here a little bit about it?
Yeah, I photographed that and I mentioned it in the book. Bond Falls is it's actually fed by an artificial, well, it's a river, but it's also amplified by a hydroelectric facility. But it's what's really nice about it is the way the water kind of cascades over the rocks. It results in the water being kind of a thin layer of water, and it takes on a real white foamy appearance. Well, and if you have photographic skills, if you take a picture of it with at a slow shutter speed, under the right lighting conditions, you'll really get a dramatic look to it too. It's the water almost looks like whipped cream or something like that.
Paul Vachon, our guide to the UP, author of Moon, Michigan's Upper Peninsula, as we explore the region and its offerings, getting tips along the way. Call in with a question. You can share your travel tips as well to the UP, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Travel writer Paul Vachon calls the Upper Peninsula America's northern paradise, with miles of freshwater coastline, hundreds of picturesque trails, countless lakes, rivers, and waterfalls. Vachon takes stock of them in his latest edition of Moon, Michigan's Upper Peninsula, and you can be part of the conversation. Call in with the question. Share your experiences in the UP, 800-642-1234. Let's go to Elizabeth in Appleton. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi. Kate, first of all, I just want to say that you're so genuine and authentic, and I feel you really represent the people of Wisconsin, so I'm was really glad that they brought you back. Mm-hmm. And
thank you.
Technically, I have to say that the UP is Wisconsin. I know that's very controversial, but I have to put that out there because, you know, I love
those
Wisconsin
are fighting
so
words, Elizabeth.
Oh, no one said I wasn't feisty, that's for sure. First of all, the pandemic happened and it changed all our lives, I feel, altered them, you know, in such a dramatic way. But one thing that happened was, my boyfriend started getting kayaks, and we started camping. So every year we go to the UP. We've been to Porcupine twice. Pitchard Rocks twice and Porcupine. It's wonderful. Lake Superior is no joke. So if you're going to kayak, make sure you have skirt, like whatever those things are that cover you on kayaks. Mm-hmm. And don't paddleboard. Please don't paddleboard. That just is awkward when we see that. But yeah, it's wonderful. Like I said, the UP might technically still be Wisconsin if anyone wants to sign a petition. But
do you need some more paddling recommendations, more kayaking recommendations?
So it can be really choppy, and you really don't know. So you definitely want to kind of forecast the weather.
Mm-hmm.
We've been pretty fortunate that we've gotten it pretty calm. It's awesome. Pitchard Rocks is awesome. You also, if you're not experienced, definitely hit up the local kayak tour companies, you know, but it's been wonderful being able to do it on our own.
Yeah.
We're avid kayakers, so.
Well, what
also,
great.
The Keweenaw is great, too, even though, yeah, anyway, that's a little secret. I love the Keweenaw. So.
Oh, Elizabeth,
yes, Kate,
thank you. Oh, thank you so much for your kind words. Thank you also for these tips. Paul, what comes up?
Well, first of all, the Upper Peninsula is Michigan. It's not Wisconsin. Okay. there's actually, and I'm just going to diverge for a moment, there's a historical footnote here. Two-thirds of the Upper Peninsula wasn't Michigan originally. The reason it was given to Michigan was because of a dispute that Michigan had with Ohio in the mid-1830s when Michigan wanted to become a state. There was a dispute over the area around Toledo, Ohio, and that was sided in Ohio's favor, but in compensation, Michigan got the western two-thirds of the Upper Peninsula. And it turned out to be an economic boon in later years because the copper that was in the copper mines in the Keweenaw, that the value of all that copper that was eventually extracted exceeded the value of the gold from the California gold rush by a factor of 10, oh, 10 times more valuable.
Wow.
Yeah, most people, I digress, though. But it's the Keweenaw is a special place. My favorite place in the Keweenaw is at the very tip. It's a little town called Copper Harbor. And I remember the TV show Northern Exposure, which took place in Alaska. And if you remember at the beginning of the show, when you see booths walk down the street. Copper Harbor is like that town. It looks just like it.
Oh, I love that. Let's go to Lorraine in Bay City. Lorraine, hi.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I just was going to mention, I'm sure it's in this book, we discovered just on a fluke quite a few years ago, Palm Book State Park near Manistique and the Kitchitakippi Springs, which is, the picture was, I think it's because I saw the picture on a tour book, and it's this tiny little state park, but it's really, really beautiful and good for people that don't want to do hiking. It's a gorgeous little state park.
Palms Book State Park. What can we find there, Paul?
Well, Kit, I don't know if you know this caller, but Kitchitakippi is, there's an aerial shot of it on the cover of the new edition. I don't know if you've seen that or not. But Kitchitakippi is special. It's like an appendage of a lake called Indian Lake. And what's special about it is it's a very, very active natural spring. And there is a pontoon boat that is tethered to trees on either end of this little area. It's not very big. And you can get on the boat and turn a wheel, and it's tethered, so you can't go off course or anything. And you can look down, and you can see the sand volcanoes of the water bubbling up from underground. And the water is so clear, you can see all the way to the bottom easily. It takes on a little bit of an aqua tint to it, but you can see fish swim by and the water is always moving. It doesn't freeze over in the winter, amazingly. So you can go there just about any time, and it's just just an amazing place. The aerial shot that is on the cover of the book was taken during the fall, so you can see all these beautiful colored trees surrounding the little harbor there. And I've been there several times. When I travel, I sometimes travel with my wife. And she doesn't usually like going to places more than once, but she makes an exception for that. She loves Kitchitakippi.
So how much travel do you get to do to make a guidebook like this?
When I do it, I usually take about 8 or 9 days, maybe 10. For me, it takes almost a half a day to get there because I live in the Detroit area. I have to drive up there. Uh-huh. And then I'll usually start, in Mackinac across the bridge, and then sometimes I'll go around like up to the Sioux and then go towards Marquette. Other times I go the other way, take the southern route, US 2, and then go towards the towards Menominee, and then later up towards the Superior Upland that I was talking about. I stay in different places. I like to try and stay in different places every time I go, probably places that are a little more off the beaten track. I like to go out and get on foot and explore things that you might not find if you were just doing research online. You can find a lot of things that way, but I like to look around and take new photographs, of course. But I like to find maybe like an interesting shop here or an interesting restaurant there that may or may not appear online and that I can put in the book. So
from one edition to the next, do you find that a number of things change, or are there a lot of things that are still the same as you go back again?
It's a funny thing. Certain physical attractions obviously don't change, but places like hotels and restaurants and museums and things, they generally, and I'm speaking of tourism as a whole, have a high turnover rate. That's less true in Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Those things tend to be a little more stable. However, there are changes and so forth from time to time, and that's why I do a lot of online research to verify things and update them. But there's always some interesting new things coming up here and there, too. And I always, and the editors want me to do, and I do this, too, is to try to keep the book fresh with every succeeding edition and put new things in too. One feature that the book has is the regular text is interrupted from time to time for something that we call a call out box. Mm-hmm. And it'll look for a specific theme. Sometimes it might be something simple as choosing a ski resort and some tips on that. Or it might be something like
scenic drives. You have a call out box for that.
golf resorts. One of the biggest, I'm not a golfer myself, but I know a lot of people that are. A lot of people that like to golf, golfing in the UP during the fall when you have those beautiful colors around you is really a special experience too. So I give some information about that as well.
Let's go to Fred in Bayfield now. Fred, hi.
Hello.
What would you like go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to share an excursion opportunity in the UP that's a lifelong Michigander. I just discovered by accident last summer, but for folks that are swimmers, there are beautiful sand beaches on Lake Superior, Lake Michigan, and Lake Huron in the UP. And if you're in a mode for a summer trip, pack a swimsuit and a towel, and in a route from Marquette to Detour, you can stop and swim in all three Great Lakes, all three of the northern mm-hmm. Great Lakes. There's a beach near Harvey, just east of Marquette. From there, you can travel through the center of the UP, through Sini, onto Lake Michigan beaches just west of the Mackinac Bridge. And in about another hour, you can be near Detour, Michigan, at the far east end of the UP and swim in beautiful beaches on Lake Huron. Spectacular opportunities.
I love it. It's a beach tour, Paul.
Yeah. And that's great. I just have to caution listeners on one thing. Swimming in Lake Superior is not for the faint of heart. It's cold mm-hmm. all the time, even in the height of summer. Now, what I do mention in the book, and what I have heard too, and this is a wonderful way to cool off, if you go to if you're on the Lake Superior side in the middle of the summer and it's a sweltering day, what you can do is go down to the beach, just wearing your swimsuit, and maybe lay down on the beach on a towel or whatever. And if there's a slight breeze, that water acts like a big refrigerator, and it'll produce a nice cool breeze over your body, and you can take advantage without actually going into the water because it is cold there. I mean, the water mm-hmm. is cold, and not just a little, a lot, all year long. There are some hardy souls that do it, but
I was just on a beach at Duluth and Canal Park, and there were hardy souls out there surfing. So it does happen. In the contrast, it just is such a contrast, though, to those sandy beaches on Lake Michigan. You know, what are they like?
On the Lake Michigan side near Menominee, those are they're usually, most of them are parks or like some cases, municipal parks, municipal beaches operated by local cities or I think there's a couple state ones too. And they tend to be very calm and very Lake Michigan isn't as volatile and as choppy as Lake Superior is. And the water, of course, is warmer too. That little region of the Upper Peninsula is sometimes referred to as the Banana Belt. And it's an area that is, for reasons of geography, is kind of an isolated corner in terms of the climate. And it's not really as cold, certainly. There's even near a little town called Bark River, which is near Escanaba in that region, there's a winery there called the Northern Sun Winery. And they have their own vineyard there. And you might think that it's really odd that in that area they could grow grapes for wine, but they do. And there was research done at the University of Minnesota that developed a grape which is a little more cold resistant, and that's what they use there. And it's some of the best wine you'll ever taste there. It's called Northern Sun Winery in Bark River. I love the place, but it's in that same region too. They call it the Banana Belt.
The Banana Belt. Paul Vachon, author of Moon Michigan's Upper Peninsula, Scenic Drives, Waterfalls, Lakeside Getaways. You can share your highlights from the UP. Call in with a question as well, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Travel writer Paul Vachon says spring can be a wonderful in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan with moderate temperatures, blossoming trees, and gushing waterfalls. His Moon Travel Guide to the region now in its sixth edition. Let's go to Jack in Madison. Jack, hello.
Hey, good morning, Kate.
Good morning.
So I was going to say, I've only been like a handful of times, but the UP really is one of my favorite places. My uncle has a cabin on the coastline in Menominee, and we used to go up there in the summer a lot, especially around the 4th of July. And it was just always cool getting out on the water. And like my cousin and I would canoe the shore of Lake Michigan, and that was always fun. I've not yet been up to the Porkies, although I've always wanted to do that. I think it's also interesting because, you know, as is kind of true of the Midwest in general, even though they're called mountains, I do kind of wish that a mountain range the size of New York's Adirondack Mountains or Vermont's Green Mountains were in the UP and Northeast Wisconsin. But yeah, it's just a great place in general. And just, it's nice that the UP isn't too far away, depending on where you are in Wisconsin for driving.
Oh, thank you so much for that sentiment and that recollection of those kid memories. Paul, go ahead.
Well, one thing I'd like to say, too, is that millions of years ago, those mountains were much higher than they are now. They've been worn down by successive ice ages over the centuries. So it was like that at one time. But I'm delighted with the caller's enthusiasm for that area, too. It's one of my favorites. You mentioned something a moment ago about waterfalls. Waterfalls are a nice thing to see any time of the year, but in spring, they're especially interesting because of the melting snow from the winter and that the runoff from that goes into the rivers, which fuel the waterfalls are much more robust during the spring. That's the time that you'll see the most dramatic flows, and it's the most scenic appearance of the waterfalls and so forth is something that you can take advantage of in the spring. And I'll put a plug in for Taquamenon, but there's many others too. One of my favorites, and it's a very small one, is near near Munising. There's a small, right outside of town, there's a river that has a waterfall. It's called Wagoner Falls, W-A-G-N-E-R. And it's operated by the state of Michigan as a little nature site or what have you. And it is the most charming small waterfall. And I was so moved by it some years ago. I took a picture of it with a slow shutter speed, like I was talking about earlier. And I made a nice print out of it. And it's hanging in my office at my home right now as I speak. And it's just a very calming presence and so forth. Many of these waterfalls, and this one's included, is they have like decking and so forth that you can walk up and take up, you know, to photograph. Usually the deckings are not so obtrusive that they're going to get in the way of a photograph you want to take from somewhere else. So they generally do them in strategic ways and so forth. But spring is definitely the best time to see waterfalls.
Let's bring in Jeff in Madison. Jeff, you are from there.
Oh, it's me. Okay.
Yep.
Yeah, Jeff. My hometown is Crystal Falls. So I'm a Uber. I was going to mention that I didn't catch the first part of the program, but did your guest talk about the Garden Peninsula and the state park there and the restoration of that old town, Fayette area? Which was originally a smelting place for iron ore back 100 plus years ago. Also, the Mystery Light near Paulding, north of Waters Meet, it claims to have been explained, but I'm quite convinced that the explanation, scientific explanation, is totally wrong. It's still a Mystery Light. And does he know anything about the huge ski jump over there in Greeley County? I think it's Copper Peak. Unable to be used because of the winds, but they're so high that you can see Canada from the top of the top of the ski jump.
Oh, wow, Jeff, lots of curiosities there. Paul, go ahead.
Okay, well, I'm familiar with two of the three things you just mentioned. The Garden Peninsula is really interesting. I've gone down there and seen Fayette is a it's a ghost town, but it's like an outdoor museum too. And back and as recently as, well, up until the 1890s, they produced pig iron at some of the foundries that were there. And that was a bustling, bustling town. But it was abandoned. And many of these ruins are preserved now, and you can see. One word of caution, though, when you go there, it tends to be, most times of the year, very, very bug infested. So make sure that you have some repellent with you when you do go there. The Paulding Mystery Light, I've seen that. There's a casino hotel, an Indian casino hotel, not too far from there. And I stayed there once. And that evening, my wife and I drove out. It's a few miles from there. And we saw that. I'm not superstitious myself, so my own opinion is there's probably some rational explanation for that mysterious light that appears. I don't know what it is, but it is intriguing nonetheless, too. It appears almost every evening, too. Mm-hmm. You look down a railroad track, and the observation point is quite a ways away. It's at least a mile, and you can see this what looks like a lantern or something, or a strong light type in the distance. And sometimes it changes color a little bit, too. It goes from white to red to maybe even a yellow at times. So I don't know the origin of it, but I'm sure there's got to be one. So.
Well, before we have to move on here, I want to make sure that we get in this. I thought it was a really great idea when traveling to Mackinac Island. And you recommend staying overnight in Mackinac City and then taking a day trip to the island, catching the first ferry. Can you talk a little bit about that aspect of being able to see Mackinac Island, but also on a budget?
Yeah. And the reason I suggest that is because the accommodations on the mainland are considerably more affordable than on the island. On the island, they start expensive and they can get extremely expensive, especially the Grand Hotel. But there's just about everything you'd want to do on the island you can do during the day when you get there. And the ferries run, Scheffler's ferry runs from Mackinac City and from St. Ignace on the Upper Peninsula side quite frequently. And you can get there early in the morning at 8 o'clock, and you could stay there till 9 in the evening and get the last ferry back. But there's wonderful things to do. There's certainly shopping and, you know, more touristy things too, but there's a bike ride you can take. There's a Michigan highway, and even though there's no cars there, it's actually an official state of Michigan highway that runs the perimeter of the island. It's about 8 miles around, and you can ride. I've done it myself, and it's a blast. It really is.
Well, Paul, this has been such a wonderful tour. Thank you so much for joining us and for just such a wealth of tips.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, thank you so much for having me. This has been wonderful.
Paul Vachon is author of Moon, Michigan's Upper Peninsula, Scenic Drives, Waterfalls, Lakeside Getaways. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.